Modern life in Australia is all about fulfilling our desires and being able to choose how we live. But Franz Kafka said, all too often men are betrayed by the word freedom. So does this mean we can be trapped by our choices and the way we live too? The characters in Kafka's novels are all trapped in some way or other, either by being imprisoned without walls in the trial or by waking up as a bug in Metamorphosis. To figure out what that bug really means, the Sydney Seminar for the Arts and Philosophy is holding a discussion about Kafka freedom and imprisonment. Dimitris Vardoulakis and Chris Fleming are giving presentations there. They both lecture in the School of Humanities and Languages at the University of Western Sydney. And Dimitris is editing a book all about the idea of freedom and imprisonment called Kafka's Cages. And they join us from Sydney. Welcome to the book show, both of you, Dimitris and Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can we start with you, Dimitris? What do you mean by Kafka's Cages?
There is a very strong theme of imprisonment throughout Kafka's works. You mentioned the Metamorphosis, where Gregor Samsa wakes up one morning and he finds himself transformed into a giant bug. And the rest of the novella takes place in the apartment where Gregor lives, and almost entirely in his room. But in many of the other stories and novels that Kafka has written, this theme of imprisonment is very strong. For instance, he's written a short story called A Report to an Academy, where a nape finds himself imprisoned within a cage, and he tries to find a way out of the cage. So by the notion of Kafka's cages, we try to address this theme of imprisonment throughout Kafka's works, which is very strong, but surprisingly enough, hardly anything has written on it.
But what did he mean when he said that quote that I started with, all too often men are betrayed by the word freedom?
Well, I think this is part of the idea that freedom is an illusion. I think the idea of freedom really arises sometime in the 18th century. And before that, people didn't really talk about freedom. And the idea of freedom arises in the 18th century as part of the Enlightenment tradition. And Kafka was very suspicious of this tradition. He was very conversant with philosophers of the time, but he didn't really believe that in our lives we can truly be free. And we're partly imprisoned by the desire to be free. And I think he critiques this idea in his writings.
Well, Chris Fleming, your focus is on Kafka's novel, The Trial. For those who haven't read it, just remind us what this is about.
Well, it's a story of a man named Brady. No, I'm just kidding. It's a senior bank clerk, Joseph Kay, is arrested one morning by unidentified agents on behalf of an unidentified authority for a crime which they never specify and is never specified through in the course of the novel. Now, he's arrested. The interesting thing is he's arrested, but he's not taken away. And the course of the novel is essentially him trying to find out what he's been charged with, how to deal with these charges, how to negotiate the court. And but unfortunately, as the story unfolds on the, you know, day before his 31st birthday, he's taken by two representatives of the court to a quarry, and they basically expect him to kill himself. And he can't do it, so they grab him by the throat and they kill him instead. So
he's not arrested. He's allowed to go on with his life. So this still fits into this idea of a cage, though, isn't it? His anxiety, I suppose, is a cage too, about what's going to happen.
Yeah, this thing. I mean, he is in fact arrested, but he's not taken away. They and he doesn't understand us. He questions me. He says, they say to him, "You've misunderstood me. You're under arrest, certainly, but that need not hinder you from going about your business." So it's an interesting idea because if we're to make a distinction, and we can make a distinction, I suppose, between freedom and liberty. He has no freedom as a kind of, he's entrapped metaphysically, I suppose. He's tracked and monitored, but he retains these kind of liberties, but no freedoms, I suppose.
So reading it, you do get to think about, you know, is he innocent or is he guilty? I mean, do we believe Joseph K. that he doesn't know what he's done? Is that the central question in this book?
Well, I think it's certainly a question that I've pondered a lot. It's one of the odd things about the novel is that it's third person, but it reads like a first person novel. Our perspective is Kay's. Our objective vision, in a sense, is what appears to him. So it's got this internal perspective, like a, you know, romantic first-person novel, but it's told in third person. Now, we never find out his crime, and we never find out whether he's actually guilty. Even so, we tend to conclude he's innocent.
Do we like him, though?
Oh, no, he's a horrible person. He's got this series of character flaws. He's got this extraordinary self-concern. He's superior and snobbish. He's fairly unthinking in his treatment of subordinates. He's recalcitrant and proud and so on. So no, there's he's not a particularly likable person. And one of the interesting things about the novel is that it almost puts forward this idea that his criminality, in a sense, lies in his in his inner being. It's almost like his moral flaws constitute his criminality in a way. But no, I think, and the weight of critical opinion too is that he's innocent. There have been some kind of counterviews to this, I'm if he's not innocent in a moral sense, he certainly there's nothing to make us believe that he's guilty in a criminal sense.
It's almost possible to read the novel in a completely different way as well, because in German the title is Prozess, which means, on the one hand, trial. And from that point of view, we can say, well, the question is whether Joseph K. is guilty or innocent. But Prozess means also process, almost like the life we live. And it would be possible to read the whole story as if Joseph K. is deceived to think that he is in trial. And matter of fact, it's his life that he is encountering and the conditions that makes his life possible. And that's what imprisons him in one sense or another. And he never understands that.
And does trial have the same sense in German as, you know, in English you say the trial, it's a trial. It's difficult, it's a drag. It's not necessarily a judicial trial, but it's a wait, you know.
I think that's the meaning of the second meaning of the process, the sense that it is a process. There is no exact equivalent of, you know, the trials of life, but it is the sense of going through a process, going through a life, a process which is endless.
So Chris, we've been talking about the trial and the individual and the character, but tell me about the context of the trial. I mean, what social and historical factors can we bring to add another layer to how we interpret the meaning of the book?
That's an interesting question. I mean, we do see, or we can see, a historical context of the book. It's written in 1925, so it's after the First World War. There is this sense of important danger, you know, claustrophobia in Europe. He's living in the dying Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, and by the time that Kafka dies, the empire is basically dissolved into nothing. And there is a very strong sense, and all through his writings, but I see it especially in the trial, this sense of critique and disillusionment that's not, I suppose, uncommon to writers of the time in the same geographical part of the world. You know, Italo Svevo's cynical, anarchic humour in you know, Confessions of Zeno, or Robert Musil's work. You do get in some writers of the same period and area a similar kind of tone or narrative voice, which is cool, detached, cynical, and often has this kind of anarchic humour. You also have the rise, of course, as Kafka's Jewish, you're seeing the rise of a a fascism and anti-Semitism, or a kind of resurgence of anti-Semitism, and you can see some of this stuff as a prophetic of what's about to happen. I mean, you do get this very strong sense of this the barbarity of modern civilization. It's that what you've left with civilization, Kafka's works, is none of the moral authority that would underpin these institutions, but simply the institutions themselves. Law becomes a kind of farce, or just the window dressing of barbarism in a way.
And what can we read into from his life at the time of writing? I mean, his letter to his father is a sort of a famous document. His relation, helpfully for you guys, I suppose, he outlines his whole history of his relationship with his father. Mm. So for sort of people with a Freudian bent, this is gold, isn't it?
It is. Fortunately, I don't have much of a Freudian bent. The person sitting opposite me, though, does.
Let the person sitting opposite you talk then. What about you, Demetrius?
I'll just repress my thoughts.
Ilias Canetti, actually, a famous German author, wrote a book called Kafka's Other Trial. And there he recounts the story of Kafka's engagement to Felice Brauer and how, in a sense, that engagement and its breakup informed the trial itself. There was an engagement, and then Kafka broke up the engagement, and he was confronted in a hotel room by members of Felice's family about the breaking up of the engagement. We see that there are definitely personal elements in the way that the trial is constructed as a novel. But at the same time, we'll have to be sort of mindful about reading too much of the personal information in Kafka's novels. I can't think of any other 20th century writer whose work has been read through his life, and I'm a little bit suspicious about that, in particular because I think this trend started with Max Brod, who was Kafka's friend, and he edited Kafka's works after his death, after Kafka's death. And Max Brod, in a sense, promoted a very particular type of Kafka, a particular type of figure that is called Kafka, and a troubled soul, someone who is on the road to sainthood.
But he knew him very well. He'd known him from when he was they were both boys together almost.
What is not very well known at the same time, though, is that there was a very antagonistic relation between the two. During their lifetime, Max Brod was by far the much more famous person of the two. Kafka published a few short stories, while Max Brod, he had a staged in the most famous theatres in Germany and in Prague. Max Brod was much more famous. And there is this sense always between them. If you look at the letters and if you look at the diaries, there is a sense of competition and antagonism between the two.
What about, if you don't want to listen to Max Brod, you being sort of interested in philosophy, are interested in how philosophers might have influenced the writing. If the life, you don't want to have the life influence the writing so much. But how do you know which philosophers he read and who he was taken with?
Well, we know from his writings that he was fascinated by philosophy. We know that he read Kierkegaard, and Kierkegaard also broke his engagement with Regina, and he mentions that in his letters and diaries, Kafka.
So which bit of Kierkegaard was he taken with? What ideas?
I think there's a sort of existential anguish that we find in Kierkegaard, but I think much more important for Kafka than Kierkegaard are people like Marx and Freud. He was reading Marx and Freud, and the preoccupation with the sense of freedom and imprisonment comes from these writers. You know, we're trapped by our unconscious. We cannot escape our unconscious. And that's a Freudian idea. Or we're trapped by the social conditions we find ourselves in. That's a Marxist idea. And these sort of ideas translate themselves in the images of the cages or of the image of imprisonment that we find in Kafka's works.
He was imprisoned by his father's expectations, wasn't he, also? Or pleasing his father, or trying to please his father, you know, without much success?
Well, we can say that from one point of view, but from another point of view, let's not forget that Kafka's father was a very, very wealthy person for his time. And he allowed Kafka to live in his paternal home without paying any rent. And
But what would you expect? It's his dad.
Well, it wasn't like the completely done thing at the time. And when we read the letter to the father, I mean, the letter to the father was written at a very particular moment in Kafka's life, when his father objected to him getting married to a person of lower social standing. And that is what kind of upset Kafka very much. So to read the relation between Kafka and his father only through the letter is a little bit precarious, because most of the time he's not that upset by his father. He's actually getting the benefit of the social and economic standing of his father.
So what does Kafka teach us then in terms of our lives now? Both of you, you can both answer this, but one at a time.
Okay.
Chris, what about you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Kafkaesque has become an adjective, so people know Kafka, at least the tone of his works, the kind of world that he sets up without actually having read him. I mean, he's influenced writers, for instance, Borges, Pinter, and so on. But the extent to which we see our current world as operating in a disorienting way, with this kind of menacing bureaucratic complexity and so on, then he does speak to us, what you might call a kind of institutional Gothic, ever-expanding bureaucracies, which whose kind of Baroque complexity that none of us ever quite to get to the bottom of. The ideas of self-confirming institutional reason, you know, this rationalization and so on. So there's a lot to see in his work that is the world we live in. And I suppose that the humour in some of his work allows us, it's a kind of critique, but allows us to step apart and see some of this. I mean, one of the things that in the trial, Kay keeps finding, you know, he can't really talk the language of the court. He asks questions and they ignore him, or he's always asking the wrong questions. He tends to, because of the complexity of the legal system and the social systems around him, he tends to find out rules only through breaking them. He can't find out, you know, what he's accused of, by whom, how he might find out, who he might contact to find out about it, and that, you know, he's silent when he should talk, and he talks arrogantly when he should be silent. And there are all these kind of unwritten, or presumably they're written somewhere, but he tends to find out about things after the fact. I don't know whether I can, you know, generalize my own experience to the rest of the, you know, contemporary civilization, but I, you know, that's often how I feel like working in a university.
Okay, well, look, in our last minute, Demetrius, what do we learn from him about attaining freedom? Is it futile? Is it possible?
Yeah, I think Kafka is prefers a critique of freedom. He says we're in vainly looking for freedom. What we should look instead is what the ape in the report to an academy says: we should look for ways out. We should not look for absolute freedom, but we should find for little ways to make our life better and more enjoyable, as opposed to this illusion of being free, this egoistical and individualist illusion of freedom.
Did he ever find little ways to make himself happy?
I think he found himself happiness with Dora at the end of his life. And when he moved to Berlin, in Steglitz in Berlin, he found himself happy then, yes.
Freedom's an especially seductive thing for... Sorry, I'm just add one thing. Freedom's especially seductive...
Is that be a short thing? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Remember.
Oh, that's what... You took the words right out of my mouth. I'll quote
Let's not stop. Let's stop here. The Sydney Seminar for the Arts and Philosophy on Kafka is at the State Library of New South Wales on tonight. So go there and if you're in Sydney and you can find out more, have more fun. Dimitris Vardalakis and Chris Fleming will be presenting at the seminar along with other guests. Thank you both for joining me today.
My pleasure.
We'll put a link to the seminar on our website. Both of the gentlemen are from the University of Western Sydney and teach at the School of Humanities and Languages. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Ramona Koval here. Coming up, Japanese ghost stories.